This podcast is brought to you by Nuveen and Ruffer. Nuveen has provided investment excellence for 125 years. With expertise across income and alternatives, Nuveen continues to expand its capabilities while maintaining its legacy as a leading investment manager. Visit nuveen.com to learn more. Investing involves risk, loss of principal is possible. Ruffer is a London-based asset manager founded in 1994, managing over $25 billion for institutions, pension funds, charities, and individuals. They have a single investment approach that aims to deliver positive returns across the full range of market conditions. Investing involves risk, loss of principal is possible.
I really encourage to follow the leader. The compensation will follow. If you're working in an environment where you have the leader focusing on the right things, focusing on you, whether that's your own personal growth, behavioral growth, whether that is opportunities to promote, because those leaders end up being your sponsors and they open doors for you through their own endorsement of you, through their own network that you would never be able to open on your own.
Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Marcy Frost, the Chief Executive Officer of CalPERS, the largest pension fund in the US with over $400 billion in assets under management and serving over 2 million members in its retirement system. She was also recently elected to the board of the Twigo Foundation. Welcome, Marcy. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
And I'd love if you could trace your background and how you came to the role in CalPERS, firstly.
Yeah, I had a fairly non-traditional path, I believe, to get to CalPERS. So I grew up in a very small town in the state of Washington on the Olympic Peninsula, a small town named Forks, Washington. And for those who listen to your podcast who are aware of the Twilight books or the Twilight movies, that's where those were set. And I remember reading a little bit about the author saying she just put in a Google search on the rainiest, darkest place in the United States. And Forks, Washington, and the Ho Rainforest, and all of the surroundings came up. And so a lot of rain, over 100 inches of rain per year in that climate. But I graduated high school from there, and I got married very, very young, had children very, very young, but also knew that I wanted something different for my family and, frankly, for myself as well. I had worked starting when I was 12 years old. I used to spend summers with my grandparents doing berry picking to earn money to buy, you know, school clothing. I worked in a real estate office starting in my sophomore year where you could forfeit your electives and be able to go out and work and get a salary. I did that. Thank you, Ms. Chandler. And then I moved to Olympia, Washington to take what was at the time just a 30-day emergency type of appointment. Emergency, meaning they needed a backfill for a position for a period of time. What that really meant was that they did need a typist, but they also needed someone who could play softball. And a female who could play infield softball because they were at the year-end tournament, state agency tournament, and they had lost one of their female players. And so the next 30 days was essentially proving yourself on the field and off the field. That then turned into a 9-month temporary appointment and then a 30-year career in that state where my last post was running the Department of Retirement Systems, which is a cabinet agency reporting to Governor Inslee, and then also a seat on the Washington State Investment Board, of which I became its chair a year after I was on that board. It gave me a seat on the Pension Funding Council, which is the group that really made recommendations on contribution rates, and then also a legislative committee called the Select Committee on Pension Policy, which was all about the pension plan design. So I did that until I got the phone call from the headhunter asking me if I would be interested in applying for the job at CalPERS. That was in 2016. I started here on October 3rd. 7.5 years later, I'm still here.
What an absolutely extraordinary story. And you're obviously a woman of many talents, if that softball talent was the first kind of entree into your public service role. And what's really fascinating is the mobility that your career illustrated. So could you talk a little bit about, within that 30 years, You went in as a filling a temporary role, but what did that look like and how intentional were you about moving through the ranks?
Yeah, that typist position, and again, because of very strong allies and sponsors for me when I was in high school, this teacher, Ms. Chandler, one of my earliest mentors and sponsors, really set me up to be successful in a business setting. So shorthand certainly isn't a skill set necessary in today's workforce, but typing and keyboarding skills, and I could type very, very well. So started as a typist. And from that point forward, it was really moving not necessarily up the career ladder, but I took a lot of jobs because I could learn from the people who I worked for and with. So leadership or, you know, a really strong team of people who I could learn from. I don't have a formal college degree. And I think that was frankly pretty surprising to some of the stakeholders, but I didn't come into CalPERS fresh out of high school. I came after a 30-year career in Washington State. So I did work in management analysis, research analysis. I did work in information technology, human resources. So I worked my way, if you want to say lattice or ladder. I worked primarily in human resources and information technology my first 15 years on the job. But again, it was about following the leader and following leaders who I could be mentored by and sponsored by, who best was going to open up that next door for me. And I felt like I always had to work harder than anyone else around me because I didn't have that traditional degree behind my name. What I had was my work ethic. I had the ability to learn new things very, very quickly, and the ability to create relationships with people, whether that was within the team or the people who I was working with and for. So about 15 years in, one of the leaders who I had worked for, she had moved on to the pension agency in Washington and had asked me to consider applying for some jobs to follow her over there. So I did that. And I went in initially running an IT project, was able to get that project. It was a really troubled project when I came into it, was able to work with people, likely the hardest places that I really had to work in terms of number of hours to get this project and the team to be successful on its implementation. That got the attention of the executives at the time, the director, the deputy director who were running that organization. And they asked me to be the human resources chief or the human resources director. So I did that, was able to have some key successes there. And then they asked me to run the IT department. So I became the chief information officer for about 2.5 years and then became the deputy director of the organization. And then when Governor Inslee was appointed back in 2013, I was sitting as the deputy director. It's pretty rare for a deputy director to get one of the more cabinet appointments without actually knowing the incoming governor. I was one of the few that was able to do that because I have this really strong belief that it's more important what others say about you than what you say about yourself. And those endorsements put me on his radar, his attention. I went in thinking I was doing this quick report out on management systems and key measurements and the things that I was doing at the Department of Retirement Systems. And what I found out later was that's exactly what he was looking for in creating what was eventually called Results Washington. So the next day he called and offered me the position to sit on his cabinet. So it's, you know, I think my career has more been one of opportunity, working really hard. And when I say hard, it's putting in the right hours, finding the things to work on, solving the biggest problems. And typically these are the problems no one else wanted to touch. And I found those the most interesting, you know, high risk of success or failure. And thankfully for me and the team, we succeeded more than we failed. But I also believe that you have to have failures to really get better at your craft. And as long as you can fail forward, learn from what happened, what didn't you anticipate would happen along this implementation, learn from that, apply that learning, and keep moving forward. That you can't dwell on the losses. You have to continue to work toward those wins.
Amazing insights already there. We're kind of getting right into the wisdom. Just a couple of quick follow-up questions. So one is that mobility without a college degree, just truly really demonstrating the hard work, et cetera. Do you think that's as possible today? Or do you think we should do more to create those kind of opportunities that just spot talent and nurture it?
I think I was fortunate that I was working in the public sector. The public sector has always been, I believe, or at least in my experience, more accepting of different attributes or different skill sets. And even in the classification system at that time, and it was pretty archaic, you could replace a year of college with 2 years of experience to qualify for these jobs that I went into. But I think that the private sector hasn't completely figured this out. I think there are a lot of women who have had different pathways to get to where they're at. It's not as traditional as maybe some of our male counterparts, whether that's experience or the fact that they've had to leave the workforce for a period of time to raise a family. And then coming back in, they're not evenly situated with their male counterparts. So I think there is some work to be done there that we need to look at the whole person, what that person has to bring to the table. And we want diverse viewpoints. We want diverse experiences. We want that in order to make better decisions. We just, I think, absent women in those decision-making tables, we really are at a loss of not seeing around all the corners. And so whether that's college degrees, whether that you don't have this very specific career trajectory or career track, I think there are a lot of opportunities still to look at those things differently.
And the point about what other people say about you being more important than what you say about yourself and those endorsements, did you solicit those endorsements or did they just come up and you weren't even aware?
They came up. So I always had the belief that if I am successful and I really are solving these problems that nobody else wanted to really tackle, but that I am proving my value, then those other things would come. I don't believe I've ever asked anyone to sponsor me or to be an endorsement for me. Those were natural progressions that happen as a result of the work. And again, I think for me, I just knew that I was different than some of my counterparts who were competing for these same jobs that I wanted. And I had to be seen differently. And being seen differently was I had a different brand. I had an endorsement coming from these hiring leaders that they knew who I was. They knew my work ethic. They knew my work product. And not that my college degree counterparts didn't have that as well, but often I was a little hungrier. I was a little more steadfast than maybe some of my counterparts who were competing for those opportunities alongside me.
I know, but a really interesting approach to mentorship and sponsorship as well. So absolutely fascinating. And now going to taking on the CalPERS role, what was your vision 7.5 years ago when you went into that role? What was maybe the problem you were tackling at that point, or what was on your mind?
So we all followed CalPERS. If you're in the pension business, we follow CalPERS. Typically, there's this belief that if it's happening at CalPERS, it's happening at all the other public pension plans, which is not an overly accurate narrative. There are times that it's accurate, but most of the time, that's a fairly false narrative. I think each of the pension plans have their own unique challenges. They have their own governance. They have their own way in which they invest and the way that they manage risk. But for me, coming in, you know, it was an underfunded system. At the time I started in 2016, I think our last valuation report had us at 64% funded. That's very distressing or distressful to the 2 million members in the system because they worry. They worry about whether that benefit, similar to what we hear about Social Security, whether that benefit is going to be there for their lifetime. And so that certainly was one of the problems that I wanted to get engaged with very quickly and try to solve. Because along with that 64% funded means that we've got a large amount in that unfunded liability that the public employers were paying, and they were paying 7.5% interest on that debt. So it was a combination of things. 3 weeks on the job, I started working with the stakeholder groups around reducing the assumed rate of return from 7.5 down to 7 at that time, and really creating that narrative about why that was important, what we really saw the investment portfolio being able to make over the next 10, 20, 30 years. Capital market assumptions were coming down slightly, yet the position of the portfolio, we had a lot of downside risk protection in it, but we also had a lot of upside potential investing, and those were not going to be done at the same level perhaps as the prior 10 years. And we really had to be really careful that the downside was going to hurt us more than the offside. There's a lot of asymmetric risk in the portfolio when you're 64% funded. So that was my first step. And the problem I was trying to solve is to get us on a better path. These are long-term issues to solve. They didn't happen overnight, and the solutions are going to be a decade to two decades to really resolve. We sit at 74% funded today. Strategic asset allocation has changed. I'm a firm believer that private assets, if done well, will outperform the public markets. We have to have appropriate liquidity to do that. And so we needed some liquidity position or liquidity management on the investment side of the house so that we knew just how much to put in the markets, how much to have in reserves to make sure that we can make those benefit payments without having to do any sell-offs. So it was quite the mosaic when I first came in. And then also just getting to know the board. The board hired me, but the board also needed to get to know me. I needed to get to know their priorities around the way we invest, whether that's climate, whether that's diversity, and how do we prove to the board that we're making meaningful progress while also fulfilling the fiduciary responsibility that they carry, that I carry, and several of our key investors. So that was the original 180-day plan, is to get a good viewpoint of where the board's position was and their viewpoints, but also to begin talking with our investment team and our actuaries. How do we change this trajectory?
And now we bring you a message from one of our sponsors of this series, Nuveen. Nuveen has provided investment excellence for 125 years. A lot has changed, but one thing remains constant. Including different types of durable income and portfolios can help investors meet their goals. With expertise across income and alternatives, Nuveen continues to expand its capabilities while maintaining its legacy as a leading investment manager. Visit nuveen.com to learn more. Investing involves risk, loss of principal as possible. And now, back to the show.
Fast forward to today, as you look to 24, what is on your mind now? And we can have a separate discussion about some of the causes and the values that you're propounding. But maybe when you look to your, maybe a year ahead, a year out, what's on the forefront of your mind today?
I think it's more around sustainable investing. The risks that we identified 7.5 years ago have just been compounded over the last 7.5 years. The push for more transparency in certain types of data that we think is relevant to managing that risk related to our capital allocation, applied some of the transparency regulations that we've seen more recently globally. But I think implementing our sustainable investing 2030 plan as a marker to get to that net zero by 2050, finding those opportunities where we can make the portfolio more resilient to some of this volatility, but also to capture the innovation, and particularly capture the innovation in climate technology that we're starting to see more at scale. So for the next year, organizationally, it's just getting everyone settled in after we're still talking about COVID and settling into return to office routines and getting people to work as a team together. But for the portfolio itself, is how do we position that portfolio so that it's more sustainable through different market cycles, including that a number of elections happening around the globe. I think there's 86 elections globally this year. So significant impact potentially for the portfolio, including a lot of geopolitical risk that we continue to try to stress test the portfolio and where we should be. So I would say that's where we're at for the next year, is really stress testing the portfolio, getting the asset allocation to where we can capture more of the private markets and private equity, private credit, and then just paying close attention to how do we best implement the innovation side of the $100 billion commitment that we made.
Amazing. And I know that you've been a strong advocate. CalPERS has for many years been a strong advocate around emerging and diverse managers. And since your arrival, you've taken that up a notch again. So can you talk about your commitment there and how you are leading in the industry?
It really is diversification. I'm a firm believer that diverse managers can equally or better compete than some of the traditional managers. And there's a lot of science, there's a lot of research that supports that position. My board certainly has that position, and our team really does as well. So a lot of it is, how do we bring down the fee drag? We'll just talk about private equity, but how do we bring down the fee drag by having more opportunities for co-investments? Co-investments mean we need to be a limited partner of choice by several of the GPs, which I think we've worked very hard to repair some of those relationships. They, I would say when I came in 7.5 years ago, based on the GPs who came to talk to me, because we had excellent relationships with them when I was in Washington State, coming to talk to me about some of the challenges they were having. I don't hear that any longer. So I think that is another good news story, that we're in a place where we're getting co-investments at a time that we have liquidity to invest. So as an example of $10 billion, I would say over the last 18 months going into co-investment, $4 billion of that went to diverse managers. And that happened through our natural underwriting processes. It simply happened because we shifted a bit of our focus more into this mid-market where we see more diverse managers. We see more diversification of the types of investments that we can have access to at scale. In the past, we felt that scale would only take us into the mega funds, fund of funds. We stopped our co-investment program. We did a 15-year look back at our private equity program about a year ago and found that we left a lot of money on the table for those reasons. One, we weren't pacing consistently across the vintages, and we weren't diversifying the way that we were investing in our managers. We do believe that we need to refine our skills in manager selection, and I think the team's been doing an amazing job there. We're not here to choose companies that we think are going to outperform. What we want to do is find the people working in those management firms who will have the ability to choose the companies who will outperform. And typically, again, our exposure has been not as diverse as we'd like to see, but just shifting into that mid-market, we're finding a lot of deal flow, and we've actually funded, again, $4 billion in diverse managers. Now, that's in addition to this new platform that we put in place about 18 months ago. And that was a $1 billion allocation. And that $1 billion allocation was split equally between TBG and Grosvenor to start funding some of the innovation side. And those are for diverse and emerging managers. I'm really happy to say that each one of them, TBG and Grosvenor, have written their first check, have funded their first manager. Look forward to the subsequent checks that they write as well. But we do believe that diversity pays, whether that is with our managers, whether that is within the workforce here at CalPERS. These are really important values, but it's more important than values. It's values and this fiduciary duty about getting a return. And we think that comes far better when we diversify the assets.
And you may have mentioned this already, but what other causes does CalPERS lend its weight to kind of really move the needle in terms of the discussion of maybe what that fiduciary duty actually means in terms of engagement? You mentioned innovation around, say, climate tech.
Yeah. So we co-founded Climate Action 100 Plus, CA 100. And part of that was really engagement. We've always had a very active voice. We were co-founders of the Council of Institutional Investors. And so CalPERS has this very long history of trying to find like-minded investors to really have an impression on the industry, to make change in the industry when we see we've got a problem to solve. So climate, certainly if we just break down E, S, and G, so the E is around climate. We want to know that the companies where we're invested, who are using our capital, that they understand the risks of energy transition, that they understand the risk of being a stranded asset, that they understand the risks of consumers having very different demands of these companies today than they did when those companies were formed. And we're seeing more of that, particularly in California. You know, sitting here in this state, we see a little bit of the front side of this. Maybe other states see more the mid to back side of it. Human capital issues around labor principles, making sure that the companies we're investing in are taking care of their human capital, that they're not successful, they're not profit engines unless they have a fully engaged and productive workforce. So labor principles and compensation and an environment that's free of harassment. So we adopted, more formalized, I should say, our labor principles last November, and quite proud of that. And that will be part of the attestation process as we're funding managers. On the G side, the governance side, we believe that well-governed companies are going to do a heck of a lot better. Well-governed companies that also have diversity on their boards for diverse viewpoints and decision-making. We like independence in governance. We like compensation to be actually connected to the performance of the company, i.e., when you do well, we share in you doing well, but there has to be risk sharing. If you don't do well, then you have to risk share in that. Your compensation needs to come down commensurate with the profitability of the company. And so I know ESG gets a lot of negativity around it, but I think once you start the conversation of what those letters actually mean to an investor, there isn't that much disagreement out there, whether you're in a blue state or a red state, about the types of risks that a large pool of capital is trying to mitigate over the long term. These are not short-term risks. You have to pay attention to short-term, but the long-term is really going to hurt you if you don't have a long-term viewpoint.
Well, that discussion of the G is a perfect segue to fund governance. And you know, you've seen two very large funds in terms of Washington and California. What would you say is the optimal governance? By that, I mean just interaction say the board, the investment, the officers beyond investment, what have you found works well?
I think it's highly dependent on the environment. What worked in Washington would not work in California. What works in California would not necessarily work in Washington State. Having a board that's mission-oriented, I think that's where there is certainly consistency. The political issues don't play in as much into investing in Washington as they do here in California. And so it's a different skill set. It's a different mindset. Where you spend your time is different here. Although here in Washington, I had the double role. I, you know, was executive director over the fund, but also worked for a governor. But then I was the chair of the state investment board. So here, having the executive role over investments and actuarial services, and we are the second largest healthcare purchaser besides federal government. We're certainly a dual mission organization. So we see a lot of interplay between healthcare and pensions in terms of having this really vital pension that people need for longevity. I think what works well is staying in contact with your board. I have a lot more contact here with my board than I certainly felt like I needed when I was the chair in Washington. Just letting them know what's happening in the organization, oftentimes, hopefully, before they need to ask. I speak almost daily with my board president. I did not speak daily with the executive director at the state investment board, only because I didn't feel like I needed to in that moment. But these issues are very, very different here. I think getting to know your trustees as individuals and not just as a collective, I think that is a best practice. Making sure that your agenda items reflect, you know, the interests and the priorities of your board. And even though, you know, sometimes we're not in full agreement about how to move forward, I think having that respect, them understanding why the staff is making a certain recommendation, us understanding why they're pushing and nudging us a little more. I think that is my role to make that translation. And so far, I think that's worked really well. And so it's relationship. I think most of these things are about relationship, trust, that we have a lot of delegated responsibility here. And we need to show the board on a regular basis how that delegation is being used, how it's being used to make the decisions that we're making, being very transparent with them on topics that sometimes might be difficult to have in this very open public meeting. But that's what we are. We're a very open public fund. And sometimes that does lend itself to more posturing than what I saw in Washington. But you just have to understand that that's what's happening. We have a lot more public comment in California than we had in Washington. And our stakeholders are really important to us. We try to hear them out. Again, we're not always going to agree, but as long as we're accessible, we're explaining why a decision was made in the manner in which it was, and that we're talking with them, that typically we find that we all want the same outcome. The disagreement is how to reach that outcome. So those are, I think, the best practices on my 7.5 years and where I've tried to spend my time is making sure stakeholders know what's going on. Many of these stakeholders are electing these board members into these seats, so extremely important to the board as well. Having individual relationships and really understanding your trustees and adopting your agendas that address those interests and address those priorities in an appropriate manner. Board education, very important. So what we try to do is look ahead a year on the agenda items we're bringing to this board and set up education sessions for them along the way. It is a lay board. These are not people coming out of the investment industry. Does not mean that some of them do not have that investment expertise, but there are no restrictive qualifications on these particular seats. The majority of the board is elected by the membership of the system. We have the state treasurer, we have the state controller, the governor has some appointments, and then the legislature also has an appointment to our board.
Absolutely fascinating insights, I think, around that governance. And it leads me to another question, which you've been in the public sector now for, I'm calculating, 37 plus years. So that clearly you have learned how to be successful in it. And some of the attributes you mentioned here, transparency, frequent contact, communication, and also just doing the work and letting it speak for itself. But I would say it's fair to say that not every person is cut out perhaps for the public sector or does not come in with the right expectations. What advice do you have in terms of succeeding in these roles? What attributes does it take?
I think you have to have very strong verbal skills, verbal reasoning to explain the why of the decisions that are being made. Typically, that's what people want to know. Well, why did you make that decision? What other options did you consider before you landed on that, either as a decision or a staff recommendation? So very high verbal reasoning abilities. I think in this role and in pension roles, you also need that numeric ability and that numeric reasoning. And those two, verbal and numeric, really match up to make sure that you are able to modify your communication to a variety of audiences. So the most expert to people who are just concerned about not having their pension, who may not have any investing background at all. But you in this role have to modify the way that you speak about CalPERS to adapt to every one of those audiences. And I know that not everyone wants to do that. Not everyone has a skill set to do that. I think for CalPERS, even more so than the Washington position, you have to be a really resilient person. I was just at this event and I was spending time with some of my former Washington network. And one of them said to me, you're the same person. I can tell you're the same person, but you have this harder outer shell these days than what you had when you were in Washington. And that's probably true. You have to have a bit of thick skin. You have to understand of these personal issues or in some cases attacks that come your way. Do they matter? Right. So does this matter? And if it doesn't matter, you have to have the mental fortitude to really put them in a place where they don't influence you. And as you continue to move forward. And when I came to CalPERS, one of my sponsors, and I've had amazing sponsors throughout my career, was a gentleman named Steve Hill. And he was the executive director at Retirement Systems when I was his deputy, and was really instrumental in getting me on the attention list for the incoming governor. But the other thing that he did is he bought me this book to say, you're in charge, now what? And it was really around creating your 180-day plan. But beyond that, just to show the investment that he had with people who he really believed in, he set up a group of a cohort for me to present my 180-day plan to. And, you know, as former governors, he came out of Weyerhaeuser, former chiefs of staff of governors, large health plan administrators, where I got to present my 180-day plan. And then they gave me feedback on that plan as I was coming into this role. And I think that was really, really helpful. And to this day, I still reach out to, if I'm really struggling with something, I'll reach out and get advice from people who are not in it, right? They're not in that fight. They're not, they can see it maybe a little more clearly. But I've gotten to the point where I know when I'm struggling. I know when I'm not seeing an issue clearly enough. I don't have the right perspective. And I just have this wonderful network and cohort that I can reach out to and really get myself rebalanced. And just acknowledging that everyone needs rebalancing from time to time, just like your portfolio, it's a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness, when you need to reach out and ask others for advice. And so I think a healthy humility in these roles, a manageable ego. I think my ego is pretty healthy and I'm ambitious, but I'm also very, very humble about my pathway, how I got here, people who I need to thank for just helping me open doors. But I think those are the attributes that you have to have. Otherwise, this is a very difficult job. And I think it's really led into why we've had so much turnover in our chief investment officer role is they underestimate it. They think that they can handle it based on headlines that they've seen, but you get in, you get into the organization, you sit in that seat, and you really don't know how you're going to react to it until it happens to you. And for some, they just don't want to do it. They may have the option to continue doing it, but these are also people who have a lot of other professional options. These are typically very successful individuals in their careers. And they do this calibration of, do I want to be here, understanding that this could happen again, or do I just want to move on with my career somewhere else? And I think that has really led into a lot of the turnover that we've seen in the seat. So resiliency is an extremely important attribute for being the CEO or being the CIO.
Well, it's very relevant to me. I'm a CIO now in a public entity. And I'd say we also need to hire staff, obviously, too, would be beneath us. And I think that's an excellent point around that resiliency. But also, when you're hiring staff, you need to be resilient, you need to grow that thick skin. You're going to have to forgo some of that bonus potential that's in the private sector. And I suppose then the natural question is, well, what's the flip side of that? What's the pro? What's the reason beside the ledger? I derive a lot from the public service and the greater mission. How would you express that?
No, I absolutely agree with you. It's more the mission and the purpose. Working for a private sector organization and really being that profit engine for a public company is very different than being a performance engine that's paying for someone's retirement benefits, and retirement benefits that might get the average pensioner here in California, you know, under $40,000 per year. And so you have to have alignment to the mission. I think that also helps with this humility issue. But you also have to understand that your role is to be a revenue generating part of the organization. We really need to up the amount of money that's coming. We call it the pension buck, but the amount of money that's being generated in that pension buck, I want to see investment earnings taking a larger share over contributions, and in particular, our employer contributions. So you have to have mission alignment, kind of that heart, but you also need that fire a little bit, that you want to remain competitive. You want to do the best that you can do, but you're working in an environment where there's a lot better work-life balance. Sacramento is a lovely, a lovely area. When I was contemplating coming here, all I heard about Sacramento is it's really close to cool things. Well, I found Sacramento to be a really nice community. CalPERS and CalSTRS both here. We have over $800 billion of capital being allocated in Sacramento, California. And it's just a really generous community. The people are very nice. But I'd like to see a little bit of that fire, that hitting a 6.8% return now. Maybe in some markets, you can be a little more passive in it. But to hit that over time, over a 20-year marker, you've got to have a little bit of fire. You have to have that competitive nature, but all for the right reasons, that you're competitive because you know you can make a difference in someone's life.
Well, I'd love to move to a few reflections and just closing questions. And I'm just going to center them on two things. One is, you've already mentioned some great mentors you've had. You've mentioned the concept of failing forward. So that's sometimes where we ask. But I'd love to just ask two things. One is your leadership style, and the other one is words of wisdom. You mentioned the people driving your career, how that was how you succeeded. Now that you're in a leadership role and have been for many years, what would you say your leadership style is?
I would describe it as supportive and engaged. I am quite engaged, but I do it through active coaching. I'm not here to be your boss. That's not my style, whatever. I don't think most people can be highly productive in a boss-telling environment. I think it really is around leadership. And so supporting the team, ensuring that they have the resources that they need to be successful, being clear about what success looks like, clarity of mission and purpose, resource allocation, of course, extremely important. And then just their leaders throughout the organization, having a set of behaviors that are all about making the team successful. That if the team is successful, the leadership over that team, all the way up to the CEO, is automatically successful. It is not the other way around. The team is not there to make the boss look good. That is not the goal. The team is there to make sure that the members are getting every bit of service that they need, whether you're directly involved in that or indirectly involved in that. But accountability is very important as well. So if we're not moving to hitting the goals that we want through coaching, then I do have to step in and be a little more directive and hold people more accountable. If you have to do that over a series of issues, then we probably have the case where that is not the person for that role. And you have to make a decision. You know, Collins calls it, are they on the bus, or are they in the right seat on the bus? Was able to do that when I first came in, and very proud to say that almost the entire team who was here when I started is still here today. We have a very productive team. We have a team that likes to have fun together, but we work very hard. But it is leadership. Management is about the work. It's, you don't manage people. The work is managed. You lead people. So I would say that's my style. And I think that I've learned over time because I've sat on the other side of these positions working for both very different leadership styles. But I know what made me feel empowered. I know what made me feel like getting up in the morning. I was maybe not absolutely looking forward, but I certainly wasn't dreading going to work. And I felt like I could be successful every day I went into the office. Those are the leaders that you want leading your teams. The people who made you feel like you weren't good enough, your ideas were never good enough, your ideas were never implemented. Those are the people you want to really stay away from. I think there's a lot of research out there. And I think Gartner is one that I more recently read, but people don't leave jobs because of comp. They leave jobs because of their leader, the people who they're working for. And to me, that seems like a really easy issue to fix as long as you have that right tone at the top.
Yeah, very good insights. And accountability is never far away in a public entity. So I think that accountability is every day we're made aware of that. My last question is around words of wisdom. You've already laced this conversation with so many of them. Maybe we can center on one or two, or just any key creed or motto or key words of wisdom that anyone shared with you or that you've come up with on your own?
Yeah, we spoke about it a bit, but I really encourage to follow the leader. The compensation will follow. If you're working in an environment where you have the leader focusing on the right things, focusing on you, whether that's your own personal growth, behavioral growth, whether that is opportunities to promote, because those leaders end up being your sponsors and they open doors for you through their own endorsement of you, through their own network that you would never be able to open on your own. They may not even be in your sight otherwise. So really encourage, as you're looking at your next opportunity, do a little bit of research on who that leader is, what they stand for, and is that a philosophy that matches with what you're looking for and what you need to be successful. My grandfather was a decorated World War II veteran. And early on, I am pretty small in stature. I'm only 5 feet tall. And I was very poor growing up. And my grandfather always said, Marcy, you're going to have to learn to take a punch. And he didn't mean that physically. He meant that more mentally. You need to build the mental fortitude that you can take a punch and know when it matters and when it doesn't. And that was my grandfather. You know, I remember that from the time I was probably 8, 9 years old, giving me that coaching. And it really was based on his own upbringing. He was a smaller stature guy as well. And his probably was physical, but what his coaching was to me is figure out how to get that, you know, that mental strength that you're going to need, because he knew I had ambition. He knew that I wanted to do more than what he was able to do. He or my grandmother were able to do. And don't be afraid of the big opportunities. I know when the headhunter first approached me, I did not apply for this job proactively. They reached out to me and I remember talking to them about, well, here's my resume, but I don't have a college degree. And I remember her saying, well, just let me present your background, your resume, and we'll see what the subcommittee has to say. And so she called me back and said, they'd love to meet you. And so I flew to Sacramento, met the subcommittee, got the call after I landed back in Seattle from the subcommittee head asking me if I would come back for a second interview. And so I scheduled a second interview, but in the middle, I really started to think about what is relocation. So there's a lot of courage that came with taking this role. I had a job that I loved. All of my family was in Washington State. I just bought a house and I was just worried about being this far, even though it's an only hour and a half flight away, it's still a very large distance. And so I ended up withdrawing from consideration for the position and got a call from her name's Priya Mather. And she just said, if you're just worried about timing, we will wait for the right person. Just really encourage you to come back out for the second interview and we can decide from there. And so I think it's having the courage to push through some of your own maybe traditional thinking about roles and really listening to people when they give you advice. And so I did. I came back out for the second interview. And then when I was boarding the flight, and that was with a full board, I was boarding my flight in Sacramento back to Seattle. The board president called me and offered me the position. And how I knew it was right, it was just, you know, it was just, you had this feeling like this is very like goosebumps and like, this is going to be a really exciting thing. So don't be afraid of the big challenges. I think you have to rely on the skills that you've been able to accumulate over your career to know, to have enough confidence in yourself to get through the tough times, but also take a few minutes to enjoy the wins. I tend to more focus on, I'm more of a hate to lose person than I am a love to win. And I have to really push myself to celebrate the wins and not dwell too much on the losses. And that's really very, very important.
Well, Marcy, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you here. And I think having worked in public funds, we all remember it always seems to come by phone call onto your cell phone, these things, but always when you're like leaving the interview or something. So we never forget when those moments happen. And not only are the beneficiaries of the CalPERS plan privileged to be part of that plan, but they are tremendously privileged, I now know, having had this interview, to have you at the helm. Everything about this interview just oozes authenticity. And there have been so many genuine words of wisdom that have come from the very beginning of our conversation. And thank you for sharing this with us and for your service. And not only can you take a punch, I think you enable CalPERS to pack a massive punch. So thank you so much for coming here and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I was really looking forward to getting to know you a little bit better. So perhaps we can do that at an upcoming event as well.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.